Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of FS Talks, the podcast that brings you the latest news and chats with industry leaders every week on Friday morning. Today's podcast is hosted by myself, Phil Creed. I'm co-founder and director of FSCom, which is a boutique regulatory advisory firm to the financial services industry. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Dowds. Mark is the new, and I think new is still fair, Mark, managing director for the venture capital fund Anthemis. Mark, pleasure to have you on. How are you?
Doing very well, sir. I've got myself nicely situated in a home office, working remotely. I think my only complaint is staring at a screen all day.
I feel your pain. And for the audience at home, listen, Mark has an enviable record in startups, in fintech and financial services. And Mark, before the interview, you had a quick look at your LinkedIn profile. It's probably more than this, to be honest, but it counts no less than six roles over the last 15 years, whether you're a founder or a co-founder. I wonder for the audience's benefit, if you could go back, and I think it'd be really interesting to go back to where it all started for you and your sort of history in fintech and possibly mention some of your biggest sort of your biggest wins, your biggest successes to date.
I'm allowed to talk about my failures as well.
I think, well, in fairness, I was going to write that in, but I was like, no, nobody wants to talk about the finish, but most people learn more, right?
Totally. Yeah, certainly not all. Well, it depends how you define success. Actually, I'll start there. Years ago, I remember I had on my monitor, I basically wrote down the sticker, and I put it on the top of my monitor, so when I'm looking at it every day, and it just said character equals success. So it was one of those moments where life was like, you know, we can define it by money, you can define it by power or whatever. But for me, I was thinking, well, if I, you know, finish my days and I remain a man of character, then that's for me the definition of success. But where it started, you can tell by the accent similar to yours, Phil, is that Northern Ireland. My dad was an entrepreneur. Now, he wasn't into tech. He wouldn't understand a thing about what I do today. But he certainly knew how to start businesses. And he had retail, manufacture, distribution. He had all sort of all of the above. So I learned through the ranks and basically how to sell at retail, how to sell for wholesale. You know, but he also had me brushing floors, you know, and doing all the stuff that the general dog's body hard work. So it was from the ground up that I learned. But my dad, when I was 17, bought me a secondhand car, a suit and a briefcase, and he sent me to West Belfast. And from a guy from East Belfast, it was a little bit intimidating. You know, and for those and listening that don't know the political divide here, it was quite substantial back then in the 80s. And so basically I learned, you know, I was sent out to sell, and I remember standing in this store, and at that particular time I was selling like animal feeds, dog foods, all that sort of stuff. And this lady came to me and said, "Hey son, you're not gonna sell much unless you start to talk." You know, I was super shy,
with a bag of feed on your back.
Yeah, basically, and it was, she was fantastic with me. I remember asking her. I said, actually, to be honest, I don't really know how to do this, because my dad had just sent me out, and no training at all. I'd done retail behind, you know, in a shop, but I'd never done it on the road, and so she basically told me, here's how you sell to me. And then so that I realized that was a strategy. So they would then go to customers and say, can you tell me how to sell to you? And and ultimately then sort of over time grew to be the top salesperson in the business, and sort of worked my way through the ranks there. But so early days hit some of my main goals in life, which were reasonably materialistic. It was have more money than I can spend, a girlfriend my other friends couldn't have, and the nicest car on the road. That was sort of my holistic goals of life. But when I was 21, you know, then I hit my goals, had a little bit of a crisis, and didn't really know what to do with myself. So it led me into deeper thinking about what I'm on this plan for, what I want to do, and some deeper searching, and went to university and all of that that particular time. Long story cut short, led me to Vancouver to start basically starting my own businesses at that time. So this would be in the late 90s. And when I got over there, I'd had this passion and interest and hobby all around tech. And so I knew enough about tech to be dangerous, and I knew how to start a business and to run one efficiently. And so I started, myself and a friend, we started Canada's first business accelerator program. So we took a facility, filled it with a bunch of people and helped them start their businesses. We would unravel what their ideas were, where they wanted to go, and then help them. We bought their computers, you know, we helped them get capitalized and started to work through that. Over time, extended that into Toronto. We took a facility in Toronto as well, and then sort of built that out and did the same side of things. And it just got more mature over the years. You know, at the very beginning, we were writing, you know, buying computers and writing $5,000 checks. And then, you know, by the time we got to Toronto, we're writing bigger checks into more focused companies, a little bit less venture building, a little bit more investment. But it was all early stage tech startup, and really through what was then or now defined as Web 2.0 and that era. A friend and I set up another company called Band of Coders, which became quite a substantial company in its time, which was a distributed network of computer programmers. It was a very pioneering business model, but also grew to, about 130 people internationally, and had some pretty big projects that we were working on over time. After doing a management buyout in that, or one of our friends, we set up a company called Service Cloud, and we ended up selling that to Salesforce.com. It was a nice exit for us. I moved west with the family to San Francisco, and of which we spent 9 years there. And 8 years ago, set up a company with one of my best friends. His name's Scott Walchek. The company was called Trove, and today it's known as sort of one of the early pioneers in the insure tech space. So it's now a platform that enables mobility, and you know, powers a lot of new models and new insurance products for companies like Lloyds Bank or Suncorp in Australia, you know, Sompo in Japan, and so on. So internationally, so over the last season, really pushed that and grew that. Our early backers in Trove was Anthemis. And right. So Anthemis is one of the largest shareholders of Trove. They've been an investor for the last 7 years. So I've known those guys for quite some time. I've known the portfolio and all the staff. So last summer, when my team basically got promoted into executive, I had the opportunity to make a change. And we've got Sean Park, one of the founders of Anthemis, sits on our board. You know, and so we ended up having a conversation about the potential of joining Anthemis. And so made the move over November 1. So I'm 6 months in the job now. Still pretty new in that. Outside of that, I've just been, you know, helping folks at home here in Belfast to set up, you know, and establish some more of an entrepreneurial spirit and ecosystem that can, you know, be good for our economy.
Which is great, and I know we're going to come on to it a wee bit later on. Trove is one of the most fascinating businesses. That it's probably when I met you, Mark, you were still in the midst of Trove, and basically insurance on demand, right? Is that pretty much a fair assumption for it?
Yeah, where it really started was the idea of an on-demand product. Is that we're thinking about what's the future risk, and you know what is the next generation that really have Netflix and other products like that, or Uber, you know, Lyft and so on. So things that are on demand and as a service. And we thought, well, why can't we break down or atomize what is insurance and bring that down to its, basically the smallest building block? And so we did that by breaking things like the annual policy. So what we did, we said, well, let's just bill by the second. So folks then have the flexibility to add on as many products as they want, so that then they can have this single consolidated bill, you know, with a suite of products. Or if they decide that they no longer, if they only want to have products insured for breakage with like their skis when they're going on holidays, then they can add that type of a product. So the whole idea was give the customer lots of control. And so we did that, and then over time then we evolved that into not just individual products like electronics and skis and sports gear and so on, but now in Australia, under the brand Bingle Go, is powered by the platform, which enables them a completely flexible mobility product that tracks where, basically, if you're a customer, it's under their brand. But what you can do is you can add your car, but then you can add and remove components depending on what you want to be insured for when. Mm-hmm. But also it tracks with where you go, so it gives you a report back throughout the week and shows you how far you walked. Whether you took the ferry or not, and basically we then give you points and discounts against your next month's bill, so that you can actually begin to see, you know, really, you know, if you're reducing risk on the road, we're going to reward you as a result of that. So the idea being is that the idea of ownership of automobiles is going to reduce over time, and so the thought was, well, what if How do we track and see where the patterns are going with, and who's taking what form of transport, so that we can then begin to put new types of policies together in the future that basically are a halo or a covering around the person's entire life.
It's, you know, when you think to the future, and you've got Google with the driverless cars and all that sort of stuff, and even, you know, some of it's now, you know, life insurance, if you wear a Fitbit or whatever, that can play into your policy, and, you know, if you keep fit, then it reduces it. I just think it's fascinating. I think it's a fascinating business. To move on sort of slightly, could you introduce, for people who don't know Anthemis, like, what is it? What do you do? And in particular, now that you've joined it as managing director, what does that role for you look like?
Yeah, good questions. I hear my dog.
This is it's all part of the show,
isn't it? I've been on calls and I've had friends, you know, other colleagues and their kids putting frisbees on their head and different stuff. But it's reasonably funny because you get a glimpse into people's living rooms and lives and the carnage of real life. Anthemis, a venture capital company, and it's 10 years old. Started by Sean Park and Amy Naukas, who had a vision of the future and of what would be financial services. In some ways, if I look back in 1998-99, when I was, you know, actively involved with early stage companies and investment, then you were looking for good tech companies. We're now, you know, that's sort of laughable because you think, well, actually everything's tech, you know, my sports gear and wearables, everything tracks and is technology enabled. And basically Sean and Amy sort of saw the future of that and said, well, you know, between industries, whether it's the merging of technology and financial institutions, or whether it's financial institutions embedding themselves, you know, more deeply into all industry, and basically brought through a thesis of investment into those pioneering companies that could become a long-term ecosystem that's resilient over time. There's other then, you know, financial investors that got institutions that got involved. Anthemis, as an example, Barclays. So Barclays then invested into Anthemis early days, and many others followed suit. So today, I mean, we've got a suite of funds, and we target everything that's interesting around what we would see as embedded finance. And as I say, that could be finance with, you know, embedded in energy and media, mobility, you know, agriculture, health and wellness, you know, education, planning, supply chain, logistics, you know. In some way, as we look at all of that, we see the future really being enabled by new financial infrastructure and service. So it's in some ways like, you know, when I was growing up, my mom always says children should be seen and not heard, sort of thing, you know. And in some ways, even some of this stuff from financial service, it maybe shouldn't even be seen, never mind heard, you know, the idea being it just enables. So we have a substantial amount of money under management. We've got a 46-person team, 55% female. So it's very, very, very diverse from ethnicity, from background and mind and experience. But also we're very strong of basically promoting female other folks who haven't had the opportunity within the venture capital world. We're based in London, New York, Geneva for the most part. There are three core offices. And there's a smattering office around different places. We invest primarily, well, up until recently, where it's been pre-seed through the Series A, but at the moment we recently just closed a growth fund for insurance. We got the first close recently of 90 million, which is publicized that is from the investors are Sumitomo out of Japan. We've got Aflac in the States. We've got, and then Daido and Nuremberger. So, you know, we have a partnership between Japan and Germany. That's going to target sort of Series B through to Series D stage companies.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a bit of a dream and a hope that, you know, that we're, you know, ultimately we're a thesis-driven, sector-focused fund. You know, but what we would love to become over time is to grow, that we become eventually stage agnostic, where we just become the specialists, as the folks are just the best at doing that in that particular sector, which is why we've really sort of strengthened out the size of the company, so that we're prepared for that growth in our future.
Brilliant. Like, you guys invest in a number of asset mutual clients of ours, but some of the most high profile sort of fintech companies out there. Since you've joined, which ones, and maybe you're not allowed to say this, but which ones are you most looking forward to sort of getting involved with?
That's sort of like asking which child is your favorite.
Yeah, but you do have one.
Yeah, exactly. But you go, well, I love that one for this. I love that one for that. Yeah. I'll name a few. I mean, honestly, I've got to say I know most of the portfolio because I've been being around the ecosystem for the last 7 odd years. But I'll highlight a few that really stand out. I'll go Flow Technologies out of, you know, they're LA based, crazy little device, you know, that basically plugs into your water mains and continuously scans to basically detects what the water pressure is. It can give you stats back on occupancy of your home, you know, water usage, you know, it has a green element to it. But ultimately then they've layered on this insurance warranty on top that basically said, we will guarantee you'll never have a flood in your home. So that's where you again get that embedded finance, embedded insurance as part of something like that. Stable, so big Richard Council, you know, farmer turned tech guy. It's pretty phenomenal stories, and he's an amazing guy. But it's a risk management platform that sort of basically protects businesses and a lot of farmers from volatile commodity pricing. And so basically you're able to sort of look into your future and basically, you know, hedge so that you're not taking a massive downturn. But the data that's poured into this thing to come up with those algorithms is quite phenomenal. Another interesting ones are Athena. They're New York based. And basically it's access to alternative asset classes. Specifically where they've started is in the art space, which is a highly volatile and sort of finger in the wind. How do you price? I mean, I know like there's valuers, you know, appraisers would shoot me for that, but I have worked with them enough to know that is very subjective. So what these guys are doing is they're tracking the price of things being sold in various auctions and so on, and coming up with a more predictable, you know, solid price where it can open up a world of, you know, as I say, alternative asset investment. Another one from a company called Centio Solutions is a product called Feel, and it's an emotional sensor. Basically, it can give you feedback, and if, depending on what access is given, others feedback into, are you happy? Are you sad? Are you anxious? Yeah. So it's basically an artificial emotional intelligence. And so if you look into sort of health and wellness and mental stability and support networks and what folks really need into the future, and there's potential, I think, with this one as well, with tracking things as deep as ADHD. So it has so much deep behavioral feedback. Yeah. And I could just give so it can allow companies to treat folks more effectively, you know, depending on their mood and their state. And over time, it can also within, you know, large groups of people to recognize, you know, you have, you know, there's little buttons you have in bathrooms and stuff everywhere, you know, are you happy, are you sad, or, you know, all that stuff. So there's
part of our experiences, like going through airport security, you know, you can actually have a live ticker or something.
There's so many applications with it. Another one in this is in the same sort of vein is a company called Patched, and it detects sepsis. You know, sepsis is a killer of many in our world. But one of the things is within sepsis, certainly in the United States, if you get that, sort of the flat bill that you're going to be faced with is about $15,000 just by, you know, contracting that. Where this little device is a wearable for folks who are vulnerable for this particular disease, and they can have it's a little wearable that gives them feedback to know and gives them alarms or signals as to know when they could basically, if they need to go, you know, set themselves in somewhere. And it can also be a remote signal for folks in hospitals if they want to remote people, you know, track people remotely. Mm-hmm. There's so many. I go humanizing autonomy. This was awesome because you think there's so much. You mentioned autonomous vehicles, and obviously when I was with Trove, we got the contract for Google's autonomous vehicles. And so learning how those machines work and how they navigate the world. But there's one thing that stands all around us, and even not just on the roads, but you're surrounded by human behavior, whether it's people on the streets, on the sidelines, and what they're doing. And basically, it's looking through the human activity and everything that's happening around that to have new levels and new sets of data, fuzzy data that can pour into these, you know, into the vehicles and much more beyond that.
That's just to predict behavior, right? So it's kind of creepy yet amazing at the same time.
Yeah, it's more to do with taking the unpredictable nature of humans and have that generically fed in to make these machines. Basically, it's almost enable humans and machines to act together safely. Yeah.
The big debate with the autonomous vehicles is, you know, it's driving along and it has a choice between a child and a grandfather, you know, what does it pick? You know, it doesn't have a choice. So I suppose that's probably to help that choice, is it?
That's exactly it. So all those behaviors that's happening that are not by machines, but by human, by humans. And then I'd probably be amiss not to mention something like Tide. I mean, Tide, one of our investments in the small business banking side of things, I mean, it's fully digital, which is really, it's strengthened and grown through the whole COVID situation because many of the banks weren't able to open new business accounts because you had to have basically people showing up to sign or meet, you know. So it sort of showed the necessity of digital, you know, in this new world. Yeah. So I think that's part of it's sort of this separation of sheep and goats at the moment that's happening, and, you know, and what's digital and what's not, you know, that's being forced as we all are, you know, having to work remotely.
Tide's growth in the last, we've worked with Tide for ages. I think we did their authorization, and their growth, they were probably 20 people about 3 years ago, and I don't know how many they employ now, Mark. It's probably over 200, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're just rocketing, and they've really cracked the nut on really how to acquire customers effectively, which is if you're on the B2C side of things in financial services, it gets pretty tough because the cost of acquisition of customers, if you don't have something unique or special that brings that along, if you're a startup, you're competing with the cost of AdWords and stuff with banks and insurance companies. You just dump cash into that. So, but yeah, they've been doing phenomenal.
That's why, like the B2C ones, very few of them, yes, they're all valued very, very highly, but very few of them are actually profit making at all or have a decent runway to profit. They're more like trying to bring different products in to use their user base to make profit. Whereas I'm sure Tyler, I understand what you're saying anyway. Next question anyway, we're obviously like in the midst of COVID-19 right now. Is Anthemis doing anything in particular? You obviously have this ecosystem, which I know sort of everyone gets together like once a year and things like that. But are you doing anything in particular to try and support companies during this time?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's changed from week to week. You know, certainly week one, week two, there was certainly a basic primal need from the startups and the startup founders, basically going, my goodness, can I survive? What does it mean? What does this mean for my future? Mm-hmm. So there was an element of fear. So part of through that era is basically coming alongside everyone and letting them know that we're there with them, which is really important. You know, that they're not in isolation. That they're, you know, we're more than a venture capital company. That we have a deep platform that enables and supports our companies. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. We've obviously been helping, you know, those who need the finances, and also been helping others with fundraising and support to make sure that they're here for the long haul. So as much as we can help, we are. Mm-hmm. On that side, then we've been having a series of webinars as well that are not just targeted to our partners but also to basically our portfolio, so that they can gain insight from a lot of our LPs, as an example. About 85% of our LPs are financial service companies, so they're invested into us, and then we're investing into the next generation and trying to bridge that gap between the two. So helping them to sort of see and hear from how these other institutions are thinking at the moment is opening up more opportunities. We're bringing emotional help and support, you know, as well. To various folks as they need it.
Mental health's huge at the minute, right? You know, it's trying to maintain that. And I know you've been working a wee bit on that. So what sort of stuff are you trying to do, Mark?
One of the things we did, it was last week, or a week before actually, we did, I interviewed Jim McNeese, who's sort of, basically a thought leader, knowledge leader, a bit of a guru in the emotional resilience space and coaching and support. So we did an interview with him on strategies of how to basically handle these emotions and so basically recognize them, label them and process them effectively. And because we recognized there's a lot of people were either lonely or fearful and didn't really know how to handle that in these, especially in intense situations, with those that you love the most, because that's where things can become most volatile. So we're putting those things together, and some of them we've not just done it for the portfolio, but we've opened up for just a wider audience. Another one we did recently for the portfolio was basically how to more effectively sell on video conference.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, it's one of those that there are unique skills, and also there's opportunities because you can go from synchronous to asynchronous instantaneously. Mm-hmm. So you can shorten sales cycles if you do this right. So we've been working with the team on that, and also we've been getting together the community, so we've been doing weekly gatherings of the portfolio and facilitating an environment where they help one another, so there's camaraderie and feeling that, okay, I'm not genuinely alone. There are other people feeling the same thing. And then learning strategies. I mean, there's people have to do really, hard things in seasons like this, whether you're furloughing or letting some staff go, or dealing with people who are not performing in times like this. So how do you do a group video conference, or how do you do a one-on-one video conference? to have tough conversations, you know, or and you know, and for some letting folks go because they've had no choice. We've been helping with the community and getting them together and that as well. Anthemis has been good from a community perspective, even pre-COVID. From the beginning of Anthemis, really, it was Sean Park predominantly sort of led through what he branded Hacking Finance. There's a thread that goes through basically continuously through publishing and different things that are, you know, basically created from the Anthemis community for the portfolio. Basically then there's an event every year where we all go to the Alps for 4 days and have.
Sounds horrible.
Oh, it's terrible thing. You know, I feel like I feel obliged to go every year. But if you can imagine like Maribel packed with, you know, somewhere between 120 to 150, you know, people that are wanting to hold on to a similar mission of bringing transformation to financial services. It's phenomenal because you get we LPs, you know, which are incumbents, and we have thought leaders and our portfolio together for some from deep dialogue and fun. So in that sense, because Anthemis has invested into that deeply over a decade, is then when you get into times of crisis like this, then there's moments where there is an existing community. It's not just a bunch of random startups.
They know each other and they feel like they can speak to each other if they need to.
Totally.
Yeah. And in terms of like the VC marketplace, are you seeing anything? Are you seeing it more active, less active with COVID? And I suppose the worry here is that from a founder's point of view, you know, they obviously need. Some firms will need money, so you know. And is it a good bad time to be investing? What's your sense?
I think one of the terms that I learned from Sean Park, one of our founders from the, I think it was week two of the lockdown, he used a term, said we're living in a time of 19 uncertainty. So I literally had to Google it.
I was like.
that sounded pretty cool, and I thought, is that a made up word? And I realized it's like, you know, it's actually an economic term of saying, like, you know, of the macro scale of global crisis and change at the moment, there is so much is uncertain, and so many of our predictions will be wrong. I mean, we have a little bit more data on, you know, today than what we had then. But again, there's still so much unknown because we don't know about second waves and all the stuff that's going to happen around us. It's directly into the market itself. We've seen a portion of folks stick their head in the sand. So we'd say if you were to break it down percentage wise, it could be 20% head in the sand, you know, 20% that really are just re-upping with their existing portfolio. You have about 20% that have come a little bit more ambitious. They're seeing the opportunity and are investing a little bit more aggressively. There's probably a small portion of those, but they do exist where there's a shift for the dirty players to move from basically venture to vulture, basically taking advantage of. And then you've got about 40% would be, you know, you can't say business as usual, but you can certainly say open for business and still actively investing. We're certainly proactive, open for business, but we're recognizing at the moment it's we are living in different, you know, different times. So we've become a little bit more patient. Not that we're impatient before, but the market has changed, and we need to be when we're being more diligent on things, because there's a trade-off on some things where there's sometimes you spend a lot of time with someone's team and you're watching the team dynamic and a lot of that. When some of that can't be done, there's more digging into other aspects of diligence as well. So we're being cautious and we're being even more diligent than ever. But I believe it's three investments we've made over the last 6 weeks. So we're still writing checks, and the industry still is. I mean, if someone has if someone has capital at the moment, they're certainly going to be watchful to know that they're not being unwise and how long is this storm going to be. But this is but they'll be investing. I think 2020 and 2021 vintage for venture capital or even for individuals that will invest could have, you know, a substantial return. For investing, it's going to be good years. It's important to remember on venture capital that if you've got a new fund, like, you know, we have in Venture Fund 2 and what we have in the Insurance Growth Fund. So those are brand new. They have a 10-year shelf life. Yeah. You know, so if there's money there to invest, this is the time to do it. And the other thing is that's happened is there's been a right sizing or right pricing. You know, basically, there's some stuff was overinflated before, and now we've got
it's more real, isn't it? You know, you're really looking at the fundamentals of the business, not where you mentioned that some are getting overinflated. You know, the business needs to be strong.
Yeah, and you see, there's a slightly lower valuation on some of the earlier stage stuff. There's a bigger hit on the later stage, depending on what their revenues are at the moment or how much more money they're going to take. That's some of the later stage, like Series C, D side of things are getting, you know, those that need to up their revenues more are taking taking a substantial hit on valuations. But there's still money there. And when you look at, you know, what's happening in the financial markets in the States and so on, I mean, it's crazy. And so there'll be more people investing into sort of longer term plays as well at the moment. So there should be no shortage of capital, and probably it'll be wiser.
Yeah. Moving forward, could you talk about some of the goals that you have for Anthemis? You just mentioned you're 6 months into the job. What are sort of the short, medium, long term goals that you set for yourself?
Several long term, you know, within the firm. I mean, it's basically strengthen the platform. As I've mentioned before, I mean, you've got the ability to invest, which obviously you need funds. We'll talk about that in a moment. But in the long term, what it is, the strength of the people and the platform that can really accelerate and, you know, success. Or help launch people into the, into the future. The uniqueness of Anthemis, as I mentioned before, it has 85% of its capital comes from institutions. So the act of matchmaking and brokering between the institution and the startup is really essential and key, which Anthemis plays a strong part in, and it's quite unique in the industry. Even personally, if I think back, goodness, it must be. It must be like 6 years, probably, that the connection between Suncorp was basically made by Anthemis or facilitated, and so in that way, and then there was lots of support and help us to put a deal together, really. So because incumbents quite often can kill startups, they just don't know what it's like on the other side, mm-hmm. And what Anthemis has become is a good fusion of that to basically bring it together. Educating, the incumbent and educating and supporting the startup. And so that is, in some ways that what it is, it's a long-term vision again of the financial service world and say, how can we bring a positive evolution, to play? So rather than sort of fuel under the fire for revolutionary heroes, we're thinking, okay, what we're looking for is the long-term vision and picture of this is to become basically a resilient ecosystem that can thrive for the long haul. We will continue to invest in diversity. We think that's vitally important for our future. We have about 16 or 17% of our founders are female. That's very important for us to have. The underserved more represented. In the United States, we started a female innovators lab in partnership with Barclays, as an example, to sort of basically push more of that through. So more diversity. We will continue to dig more into what is embedded finance. What does that look like in our future? where are the emerging markets that we're going to see that? I mean, if we look at Teams, Zoom, all the video conferences, what happens if we start living more in those platforms? What happens to the exchange of finance and of that as well?
Yeah.
So new platforms and things like that. But embedded finance is really a strong core of what we're really pushing forward, and to educate people on what that means, so that, because really in some ways, folks did have us pegged into fintech, and
yeah.
But what that means, when you heard me speak about the portfolio, you're probably going, what the heck has that got to do with fintech?
It's nice to hear different types, which the definition of fintech is a long running sort of, I don't know if it's bugbear or whatever. It's like, I think it's time to get over that, if you know what I mean, and just go, what's making financial services better to the biggest audience, which I think is probably what you're getting at, but I'll not put it in your mouth.
Yeah, it's virtuous cycles and also purpose, purpose with a profit, or a profit with a purpose.
Yeah.
So that it's not just money making people rich. This is money bringing transformation to the world. As we look at energy and we look at, sustainability and that side of things, it's going that those aspects of things in our world are only going to increase because they become more vital to our generation. I mean, I think previous generations ignored because they thought, well, it's not going to affect me. I think all of us realize it's already affecting us. So how can we be preventative? So there'll be more of that. And also, as we dream big, as I said, we're in a very sector focused company, we would love to become stage agnostic. So whether you're the guy that's writing something, basically has an idea in the back of a napkin, or whether you're sort of later stage needing some like debt and buyout, so we want to be part of that ecosystem to facilitate that, so that we can really see those folks that have brilliant ideas and thoughts, or maybe there's brilliant people that have fledgling ideas that need to evolve, but to get behind the right ideas and the right people to grow that into substantial change in our economy and our world.
Brilliant. And Mark, just to sort of get back to home a wee bit, Mark's also a founder of the Ormo Bass, which is a fintech hub in Belfast, and has been heavily involved in the Northern Ireland fintech scene since she came back. I wonder if you could just, for our home roots, comment a little bit on the market in Northern Ireland, and if you could ever see a fintech unicorn coming out of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
What do we need to do?
Yeah, and I'll give a little bit of the background is that there were a few of us that saw this beautiful building called the Ormo Baths. It's called the Ormo Baths because it's on this road or avenue, Ormo Avenue. And it's a Victorian bathhouse that was built in 1888, the same year that Belfast, was named the city. And so we've taken it over and renovated it and basically set it up as a tech startup hub. So within it, we have a pre-accelerator, Propel, we've got Accelerator Ignite, we've got Games Incubator, we've got a VR lab, because we've got a host of partnerships in that. It's we're partnered with Barclays Eagle Labs as well, and the idea, and in that, we up until recently we were running about 30 events a month, and mostly by the entrepreneur for the entrepreneur, but we would also, through other partnerships, we would bring in sort of leading voices like Sarah Fryer, who those of you who don't know her, she was basically CFO of Square. We had loads of people like that normally folks in Belfast don't have access to, these Silicon Valley, folks have grown through, but there's a lot of expats and we've got good networks. But in that, there's so much happening. And then I have the joy of being chairman of TechStart Ventures, which we invest into early sort of pre-seed Series A, companies as well. And there's over 60 in the portfolio now, and growing well. So I get to sort of hear and see. My wife runs the Ormo Baths, so when I come home from work and she comes home from work, which today means I go downstairs and she goes to the living room. this is sort of the commute home, is yeah. that, you know, I hear what's going on. When COVID hit, we shut the Ormo Baths down and gave all the startups rent free. We immediately said, let's be generous to the community. But we maintained Jenna, who runs day to day, basically as on staff. So we're still paying her to proactively nurture the community, even while still at home. So we're still sort of seeing what's going on. And I get to see through the Propel and Ignite programs, I see all the stuff that's happening and surfacing in Northern Ireland. So between that and TechStart, I get to see a lot. So, but he asked me, you know, what I see coming out, you know, I'd be amiss not to actually call out artificial intelligence, you know, automated intelligence, basically, are not artificial. So automated intelligence, are basically target the financial services firms. And I recently became their chairman on that. And I see that as a scale-up company data company that can take basically archaic, you know, institutions into the future and help them to become more compliant around their data. So I think that one, you know, I wouldn't have become chairman if I didn't think it had big growth opportunities on that one. I've been tracking and I've been an advisor for Neurovalence, so with Jason and what he's doing there around the devices that can, you know, benefit you from a weight loss perspective, anxiety and sleep. I mean, I think that is another fintech. Well, folks are going, how the heck is that fintech? Well, I mean, if you get into medical services and the expense around that and what we can do on preventative care, it's absolutely huge. And then you can look at big data companies, which, you know, I'm not involved with, but like Deep Labs and some of the data that they're playing and what that can play into in financial services as well. So, we've seen huge success with companies obviously like Kainos already that serve the, you know, financial services sector. So we've had some scale ups, but there's a lot emerging now. And if we've had, in some ways, the last four, you could claim maybe 5 years, there's been a lot more active and smart investing in the Northern Ireland, and as a result of that, we're going to start to see some burst out now, which is super exciting. And we've also had some come and relocate. So we basically set themselves up in Belfast so that they can benefit from the ecosystem, benefit from the capital, and it's cheaper living here as well. So I mean, that's unbelievable.
No, we're definitely, I think, burgeoning a reputation of certain specific areas, of which compliance is definitely one. Marcus, no, you know, FS call, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
you didn't have to say it.
Well, you know, you guys are partnered with automated intelligence. You've got to do the internal plug as well.
No, listen, Mark, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and thank you very much for joining us. I think, you know, everyone watching or listening will agree that Mark's a true gentleman, and it's always good to meet people who are passionate about their job. You know, it makes doing things like this a lot easier. Next week, we have Charlie Dillingpool, who is founder of Comply Advantage, and we'll be talking all things transaction monitoring and AI. So look forward to speaking to you next week.